Now we come to the magazine, whose editor this week is Margaret Ray. Articles include More Than Just Carbonara, Terrible Traditions, Create a Haven for Bird Life, Mothering Sunday or Mother's Day, and a poem by William Wordsworth. More Than Just Carbonara, and this article appeared in the Darlington and Stockton Times. Gennaro Contaldo might have dedicated his life to Italian food, but admits he didn't know just how much variety there is in his country's cuisine. "It's incredible. I didn't know myself," says Contaldo, who grew up on Italy's Amalfi Coast, before moving to the UK more than 50 years ago. Contaldo, known for his numerous TV appearances alongside his protégé Jamie Oliver, cites with glee the fact that there are about 600 known shapes of pasta, and God knows how many other thousands. "Each family makes their own versions, their own way," he adds. Contaldo explores the varied nature of his home country's cuisine in his latest cookbook, Hidden Italy, which is split up into four geographical parts: Central Italy, the islands, the north, and the south. Ultimately, he wanted to show people that Italian food is not just carbonara, bolognese, cacio e pepe. Not that it was particularly easy to find some of these recipes. Nobody's writing any books about those original recipes and where they come from. So there was a lot of research, nearly 2 years of research, notes Contaldo. "It's not like these recipes disappeared," he says, "but they hide. Families are still doing it." However, 77-year-old Contaldo is keenly aware that the world is changing. "Generations are changing, the world is changing, and we don't want all these beautiful recipes to get lost. They're still there, nothing will be lost, but it's nice to put them in writing." Through his research for the book, Contaldo met people still making some of these lesser-known recipes and stresses that there is a story for every single food. Take the pasticcio di pasta alla ferrasi, a type of pasta pie made from tortiglioni or rigatoni, baked in a mince meat ragu and bechamel sauce, all topped with pastry. Its origins come from noble banquets during the Renaissance times, with the recipe spreading from Ischia, on an island near Naples, to all over the country. "They share recipes. Italy's like that," Contaldo explains. "Italians, they communicate, they speak, and they transfer their love through food." With so much history attached to each dish, Contaldo says, "It's not just spaghetti and a glass of wine. Italy is an emotion." Italian households are used to making fresh pasta for their meals, something that is much rarer to see outside of the country. But Contaldo urges people to give it a try, calling it so easy. He adds, "It's not scary. They should try. It's cheaper. Ordinary flour mixed with water. It's so easy. If you do it with eggs, one egg for 100 grams of flour is all you need. Then you have almost 200 grams of pasta," he explains. "Once boiled, this gives you enough to easily feed two people, even three." One of the best things about making your own pasta is being able to make your own shapes, according to Contaldo, who says he makes endless shapes. You can even use your pasta dough offcuts to make something called fazoletti, which translates to silk handkerchiefs, so nothing is wasted. If you do buy dried pasta, and nothing wrong with that, with Contaldo saying it can be magnificent, just watch out for what's in it. You have to be very careful when you buy pasta, because they make pasta all over the world, but they use rubbish flour and God knows what kind of eggs, he says, urging people to buy proper Italian pasta. And of course, make sure it's cooked al dente, and your stomach might thank you. You chew it longer when it's inside your mouth. It tastes better. You digest it better. It's beautiful. Compared to the Italian approach to food, Contaldo says that Brits eat too quickly. If you go into an Indian restaurant, if something is hot and spicy, you find yourself saying, "Oh, it's spicy, it's spicy." You eat faster. You don't taste anything. Italian food is simple. What you see is what you eat. You want to taste the carrots. You want to taste the beans. He says of the difference between the two countries. In England, it's the culture of drink. In Italy, it's the culture of food and wine. In Italy, Contado says, the food and wine is balanced. Water is to drink, but wine is to flavour the food, to help ingest it. Everything else, it's all about the friendships, the philosophy. That's why Contado has dedicated his life to keeping Italian culture alive, he says. And he's still constantly surprised by what he learns, even though he hasn't lived in the country for decades. There are many Italian restaurants, especially in London, where you find a dish that you haven't done before that's a special, and the chef put it on because it's part of his culture. Ultimately, Contado says, I cook from north to south, and I cook from the Amalfi Coast. I want to remember where I came from. I want to know my roots.
Terrible Traditions by Chris Lloyd in the DNS Times. From caves to Quakers and on to cheesemakers, the Yorkshire Dales are packed with great stories and traditions that make up their unforgettable character as much as their rolling fells and windswept moors. For instance, at Mooka, the womenfolk made a special cheesecake ahead of the Ard Righ Christmas festivities. The young men would begin the celebrations by wandering the street wearing large aprons. The women would throw out the cheesecakes and some cooked meats for them to catch in their aprons. Something similar happened at Redmire, where, at feast time, the Redmire cheesecake gatherers in ludicrous fancy dress went from door to door carrying baskets. They would refuse to leave a house until the resident placed something tasty. The expectation was for a cheese curd cheesecake in a basket. Sadly, says Mike Appleton in his new book, Celebrating the Yorkshire Dales, the tradition no longer takes place, but they still hold a domino drive. It can't quite be the same, though. Mike, a keen caver and walker, has plenty of stories in his book, like The Terrible Knitters of Dent in Cumbria on the western edge of the Dales. The knitters weren't terrible because they were rubbish. Indeed, during the Seven Years' War of 1756 to 1763, the English army was clothed in their worsted stockings. Terrible refers to the ferocity with which they knitted, but also the way they would rock back and forth whilst removing the loops, says Mike. However, the terrible knitters were also feared because of their tendency to knit in clusters so they could carry on their terrible gossiping. In the days before department stores, everyone in the Dales had to knit, with the two-colour midge and fly pattern being especially popular. It was a job for all, says Mike, with men knitting as they walked to the mines. The strangest things seemed to happen in the Dales. For instance, a little stream runs through the churchyard at Kirby Malham, at the southern edge of the Dales. Colonel John Harrison spent much of his life fighting overseas in the army, so his wife, Helen, asked that they should be buried on either side of the stream, as water parted us in life, so it shall in death. Helen went first and was buried on one side, and a plot was reserved for John on the other. But when his time came, sadly, the gravedigger couldn't get through the hard bedrock to create a separate grave, and so they were buried together, says Mike. Another story concerns the Ribblehead Viaduct, one of the most famous railway viaducts in the country. With its 24 arches, this iconic structure has been the settle to Carlisle Railway since the 1870s. Amazing as the line is, Dr. David Johnson says we aren't giving the viaduct its real name, says Mike, before quoting from Dr. Johnson's Discovery Walks in the Yorkshire Dales. Dr. Johnson says the correct name for the viaduct is Batty Moss. Mrs. Batty ran a popular shebeen, an unlicensed drinking establishment, and by all accounts was a very forceful and domineering lady. As might be expected, Mr. Batty was mild, inoffensive, and henpecked. Eventually, he tired of his wife's aggressive nature and concocted a cunning plan. He persuaded his wife to tie him up and push him into a deep pool, says Dr. Johnson. She obliged with the tying, but just as she was about to push him in, he jumped aside and his dearly beloved fell headlong into the pool and drowned. Originally, the station here was to be called Batty Wife Station. Still, the viaduct was named after the story of Mr. and Mrs. Batty, with moss referring simply to the moorlands that surround it. Not all of these stories come from distant days. For instance, the Black Bull in Reeth dates back to 1680 and is the oldest pub in the village, but it became famous in the 1990s when landlord Bob Sykes removed the flaking white render from its exterior to reveal 300-year-old stonework. The Yorkshire Dales National Park planners ordered him to reinstate the render, arguing that was how it was meant to be. And a 4-year standoff developed, with Mr. Sykes turning his Black Bull name board upside down in a satirical complaint about the topsy-turvy nature of things. His standoff became so well known that a popular Australian breakfast television show was broadcast live from the village. In 1998, he lost his battle with officialdom and was forced to restore the render. But he left the sign upside down and created a story that would be told with a laugh for generations to come.
Create a haven for bird life. And this article's by Andrew Willocks and was found in the Darlington and Stockton Times. Not too long ago, we were experiencing more traditional winter weather than perhaps we would have liked, with snow and ice appearing across the UK. As a matter of habit, we take precautions and stock up on essentials or reroute and cancel journeys until conditions improve. The birds that visit our gardens are no different. Like us, they need warm shelter from bad weather and a reliable source of food. Some of the trees and shrubs we plant can benefit many bird species that become reliant on gardens during winter. Each evening at RHS Garden Harlow Carr, blackbirds, song thrushes, mistle thrushes and their Scandinavian cousins, redwing and fieldfare, gather on berry-laden trees and shrubs such as cotoneaster, crab, apple, yew, sorbus and holly. They feed voraciously before retiring to the shelter of evergreen trees to escape the winter chill. Dense evergreens, such as Cryptomeria, juniper, cypress and pine, provide excellent cover, and the temperature inside a thick yew or Lelandii hedge can be a couple of degrees warmer, making them popular refuges. Where gardeners once cut back herbaceous plants in late autumn, many now leave them until spring. Plants such as helianthus, asters and solidago provide seeds and shelter for robins, dunnocks, bullfinches, goldfinches and greenfinches throughout the winter. At RHS Harlow Carr, we occasionally see woodcock sheltering and probing for food along the herbaceous borders. Though classed as a game bird, its numbers have declined, with additional birds arriving from the continent during colder weather. Another unusual visitor has been the water rail, more typically found in reed beds, but sometimes appearing near small ponds and streams in cold spells. Both species travel at night and may arrive unexpectedly. One of the most effective ways to help garden birds is to feed them. Hanging feeders can offer mixed seed, peanuts, Niger seed, suet and fat balls. Place feeders close to shrubs so birds can escape predators, such as sparrowhawks, and make sure to clean feeders regularly with hot water or pet-safe disinfectant to reduce the spread of disease. Bruised and damaged apples from the apple store have been providing additional food left out by the bird feeding station at Harlow Carr. Malus crossed with Everest, an AGM, is looking amazing at the moment, Growing around the top end of the kitchen garden, it is providing plenty of small crab apples for the birds. This plant is suitable for most gardens, however large or small, and also works well as a good screen and windbreak. Water is equally important for birds, providing both drinking and bathing opportunities to help them maintain feather condition. Bird baths should also be cleaned and refilled regularly. If you have a pond, ensure it has a shallow edge so birds and hedgehogs can enter and leave safely. Native hedgerows of field maple, holly, blackthorn, hawthorn and honeysuckle create habitat for invertebrates that feed birds, while also offering berries, nesting sites and shelter. Even a small hedge or a single hawthorn can help to create vital wildlife corridors. Finally, once you begin feeding birds during winter, continue consistently. Birds quickly become creatures of habit and may rely on your garden as a dependable source of food and shelter.
Mothering Sunday or Mother's Day, which is it? By Margaret Ray. As a child, I attended St. John's Church Sunday School, Darlington, where my parents were married and I was baptised. The nearest Sunday to Mothering Sunday, all the children attending Sunday School received a very small bunch of snowdrops gathered in the wild by the teachers. This was carefully carried home and presented it to Mum when we arrived home. It was received with thanks and a hug and a kiss, a simple gesture but very meaningful. What have we now? Mother's Day. This is advertised from Valentine's Day until the day before the celebrations. Cards and gifts of all shapes and sizes, some reasonably priced to the very expensive and ridiculous. What does this mean to a mother or grandmother? I am fortunate as I have received over the weekend an expensive bottle of wine, a beautiful plant, artwork for the garden wall, a lovely bouquet of flowers and chocolates. These are from my two sons and two grandsons. I treasure all the gifts they give, but most importantly, they remember, which is better, a simple token of love or an expensive gift. Whatever we receive, we appreciate as mothers and grandmothers. I feel spring is now well on its way. The daffodils are in full bloom. The crocus and other bulbs are pushing through the earth and showing colour. This brings to mind William Wordsworth, "I wander lonely as a cloud." Daffodils.
And here is Daffodils by William Wordsworth. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretched a never-ending line along the margin of the bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft, when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon the inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils.
So that brings us to the end of this edition of The Talking Newspaper. My thanks to all involved in this week's production. Don't forget, we want to hear from you with any comments you have about the recordings. Do call us on Darlington 465101. If there is no one in the office to answer your call, leave a message and we will get back to you. Or you can email us at dtnewspaper@outlook.com. Until next time, look after yourselves. From me, Pat Walker, and all the team, goodbye.